Good morning, Fairbanks. You are listening to KFAR Radio. We are at 660 AM or 97.5 on the FM dial. You can also live stream us at KFAR.com. This is Problem Corner. I'm your guest host, Nick Nugent, filling in for Dave Prus, who's off doing some official mayor business for the city. Well, today is Wednesday, so our topic will be something historical. I hope I have a good show lined up for you this morning. I'll be talking about the early ascents of Mount McKinley. We will use the name Mount McKinley throughout just because that was what was historic in all the documents. So, if you would like to call in, you can do so by dialing 458-TALK or 458-8255. We'll try to get to your call. The story of the climbs of Mount McKinley, of course, start with the discovery of Mount McKinley. And that took place almost 150 years after the first presence of Europeans. The continent's highest peak was unknown to cartographers and geographers in spite of its 20,000-foot height and being clearly visible from salt water. Vitus Bering had discovered mainland Alaska in 1741 and observed 18,000-foot Mount St. Elias, but he was never in a position during his voyage to see the peaks of the interior. 1778, Captain James Cook, the British Navy, was sent up by the Admiralty, sailed up the inlet now named for him. Possibly due to weather, he does not mention seeing an inland range. 1794, Captain George Vancouver, while charting the northwest coast of North America, ventured to Knickarm and noted on May 6th that they could see stupendous mountains and covered in snow with several peaks to their northwest. This then is accepted as the first recorded sighting of Mount Foraker and Mount McKinley by Europeans. 1830, the Russian-American Company was expanding into the interior and began explorations on the Yukon, Copper River, Susitna, and Kuskokwim. These efforts led to a report in 1839, which became part of a 44-volume encyclopedia of the Russian Empire. Governor Wrangel compiled a map showing these rivers and included the Kwikpak, which was what the Russians called the Yukon. Cook had missed the Yukon Delta due to fog. The map also showed mountains named Tenaya and Shimigut, which correspond to Mount McKinley and Foraker. Some of the Russians came as close as 50 miles before supplies ran low. The Russians were hoping for a crossing to be found from the Kuskokwim drainage to Cook Inlet. That feat actually took until the 1890s to complete, and that was by U.S. Army parties. A Russian named Zagoskin in 1847 left the mountains off his map. He had not approached close enough to undertake detailed work, and not wanting to record error, he recorded nothing. This map, being newer, was thought to be more accurate, and the Russian history with the area right around Mount McKinley was lost at that time. Well, William H. Dahl, who had first reached Alaska in 1866, described the interior ranges as terra incognito in an 1880 report to Congress. In 1870, while at the confluence of the Tanana and Yukon rivers, Dahl was able to observe the sweep of the mountains, which he referred to as the Alaska Range. In 1875, Arthur Harper made the first known journey down the Tanana by a non-native person. He repeated this trip in 1878 with Al Mayo. Harper described the north side of the range and made several references to Mount McKinley. An explorer named Frank Dinsmore then led a group from the Tanana to the Kuskokwim by way of Lake Minchumina in 1889. His descriptions and writing about it got people to start calling it Dinsmore's Mountain for a brief time. In 1902, Alfred H. Brooks of the USGS became the first non-native to set foot on the mountain proper. Brooks noted in his report that the natives had no fixed name for many large geographic features. He noted that the interior people would call it Denali, those along the Susitna, the Doleka, and the Cook Inlet peoples Treleleka. Add to that Bolshiara Gora, which was the Russian for Great Mountain. By this time of Brooks, approximately 100 Europeans had seen the mountain. Well, a Cook Inlet gold rush of 1895 brought William A. Dickey, who was a Princeton graduate, north. He was the first to accurately estimate its height. He gave it the name which stood for years and brought it to public attention in an 1897 publication. Dickey, by the way, was an excellent baseball player and helped develop the modern curveball. Dickey wrote dispatches to the New York Sun recounting his explorations. A mountaineer in their party estimated Mount McKinley to be 6,000 feet higher than Mount Rainier. Mount Rainier's 14,000 feet, so it was a very good estimate. Dickey then goes on to describe how they named the mountain. They'd met a pair of prospectors who were, as he calls them, rabid proponents of the silver standard. This became so intolerable to Dickey's group that they named the mountain after William McKinley, a fierce proponent of the gold standard. Dickey returned to Alaska in 1898 and was off to Dawson, where he discovered the richest claim on King Solomon's Dome. He lost the claim in litigation with Canadian officials. In 1899, he was a member of the Harriman Expedition, which we've talked about on this program, and finally discovered copper at three Prince William Sound locations. And with that, I think we can go ahead and take a commercial break. We will be back in a very short time.
More Problem Corner is coming up on KFAR 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at kfarradio.com.
The Valdez Fishing Report, brought to you by Frontier Supply Company on Van Horn Road, the only Alaska-owned full-line wholesale distributor of plumbing, heating, industrial piping, waterworks, and mining products for over 30 years. Sure, they're big enough to handle the supply needs of pipelines and gold mines, but they're personable enough to help you with your needs as well. Frontier Supply Company, for all of your plumbing and heating needs, on Van Horn Road, online at frontiersupply.com. That's Frontier Supply Company.
It's time for the Valdez Fishing Report. Interviews, derby standings, tips, and advice for Prince William Sound.
This is Barrett McCombie with an update on fishing in Valdez. LaVon Basinger of Fairbanks says she will be babysitting grandkids while her daughter-in-law fishes the Valdez Women's Silver Salmon Derby this Saturday. But she is hopeful that the 14.54-pound silver salmon she caught Friday will stay in the lead for the overall Silver Salmon Derby. Basinger said she and her husband were fishing just past Sawmill Bay and caught their limit of 6 fish in less than 3 hours. David Kaios of Toke is currently in second place overall with an 11.76-pound silver, and Jen Saxon of Valdez is holding on to third place with an 11.34-pound fish he caught on July 29th. Last year's winning silver salmon caught by Marco Hovind of Toke weighed in at 14.84 pounds. This year's Women's Silver Salmon Derby will feature a Friday night pirate treasure hunt event. Everyone who registers for the Women's Derby will get a 2023 dog tag, and if their number is posted at sponsor locations, they will win instant prizes. There will also be an opportunity for women to compete in a group costume contest by taking a picture at the weigh-in station. There will be door prizes announced on the Women's Derby page of the Valdez Fish Derby's website, and women will register to win one of three prize packages at registration. Leaderboards just below the Harbor Master's office and the weigh-in shack will be updated as fish come in. Women's Derby weigh-in closes at 6 p.m. on Saturday and at the weigh-in boards down to the Valdez Harbor.
Call Fish Central and get out on the water to catch fish and fill your freezer this summer. Chris Central can hook you up with charter reservations or a boat rental and give you the advice you need to navigate the local waters. Once you've caught your limit, bring it in for processing. Visit fishcentral.net or call 835-5002 to book your fishing adventure today.
KVAK's Valdez Fishing Report. Fish Valdez and reel in a big one.
KFAR weather.
Overcast skies today with scattered thunderstorms likely. Daytime highs approaching 69. South winds around 5 miles an hour. Cloudy skies expected tonight. Scattered thunderstorms likely. Lows around 57. Cloudy tomorrow. Scattered thunderstorms likely. 73. That's your weather on KFAR 660 AM and 97.5 FM. I'm meteorologist Eric Height.
And now, more Problem Corner on KFAR Radio, 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at kfarradio.com.
Welcome back to KFAR's Problem Corner. We're going to now resume our discussion about the early climbs of Mount McKinley with myself, Nick Nugent. If you'd like to call in, you can do so by dialing 458-TALK or 458-8255, and we will try to get to your call. Well, we talked a bit about Dinsmore's group and how Mount McKinley got its name. And again, I'm sticking with Mount McKinley simply because that was the name during the time that we're looking at. In 1898, then, a survey party was dispatched by the government, had two members, George Eldridge and Robert Muldrow, both of whom have glaciers named for them. They very laboriously ran a stadia line up the Susitna and, from six different locations, 43 to 89 miles distant, measured the South Peak by triangulation, came up with a height of 20,464 feet above sea level. If you'll remember, for a very, very long time, the mountain was thought to be 20,320 feet, although the most current USGS is showing it as 20,310 feet. Not quite sure who swiped our 10 feet. Well, 1899 saw Lieutenant Heron cross the range in a 1,000-mile trek from Knik to the Tanana-Yukon confluence. He named Mount Foraker as he passed through the area. His exploration was truly a major accomplishment, and though there are some mapping areas, the value far outweighed any error that was on. As mentioned before, Brooks came through in 1902. He followed much of Heron's route, though he used Rainy Pass, which he also named. After 5 weeks' transit, they were on the north side in the foothills. Brooks' work is still the starting point for many studies of Mount McKinley and was truly quite an effort. The first publication from his efforts was an article called and titled A Plan for Climbing Mount McKinley, which appeared in the January 1903 National Geographic magazine. Brooks proposed coming in from the north as the route from Cook Inlet was excessively long. That was a very accurate prediction. During the next decade, there were 11 expeditions from the Cook Inlet side, every one of which exhausted themselves and their supplies. Four came in from the north. Three of those were successful in locating the route, which, in 1910, allowed access to the North Peak, and in 1913, to reach the South Peak, which is, of course, the true summit. One thing I'd like everybody to notice, these early climbs came from two sources. Many were from the Explorers Club in New York City, which included some of the finest mountain climbers and outdoorsmen available. They were heavily financed to the tune of tens of thousands of dollars. The Fairbanks climbs, on the other hand, were mostly put together by groups of guys sitting around in a bar, slightly bored, and would go for as little as $1,000. And I guess we can see that the toughness of the Fairbanksons, and perhaps the fact they weren't mountaineers, they just said, well, there's a mountain, it's covered with ice and snow, let's go climb it. Well, Wickersham's party set out in spring of 1903. His story is well known. It's been covered here on this program before. By early May, his court was organized, but no activity was scheduled till late July. So Wickersham decided to ascend Mount McKinley. They booked the steamer Tananaw Chief to Kantishna and as far up that river as they could travel in a day. They departed from Chena May 16th, arrived at Kantishna on the 17th, and traveled upriver till the morning of the 18th. They were fortunate. They met a trapper named Butte Aiken. He was on his way to St. Michael with large bundles of furs. He had been in country for almost a year. Aiken provided good information regarding the way ahead and then departed for St. Michael. They came to a village of about 50 people, and some young men who had been to mission school were able to interpret for them. They explained their plan to travel to the summit just to see it. The young men and some of the other natives left because they did not wish to spend time with those that they considered mad. Well, they set out lining their launch upriver with the help of two mules. By June, they were well past any more villages and were able to take some caribou and prospect. Something else to look at on these early explorations, most of them did not even arrive at the base of the mountain until what today modern climbers would consider the end of the climbing season. They took caribou, they prospected, they filed a few mining claims, the first in the Kantishna area. They reached the mountain proper on June 18th, 1903, set out the next day with supplies, including sleds of firewood, the only fuel available. June 20th, they had learned to travel by night when the snow was a bit firmer. On the 21st, they were above 10,000 feet, which is pretty remarkable progress, and were making decent progress with about 9 hours of travel per day. With very clear weather, they also realized they did not have the amount of supplies they needed to continue, so they turned back. Well, interestingly, Wickersham decided that since they had traveled higher than Brooks, they should rename some of the local features, especially glaciers. A few of these names persisted until 1947 in alpine literature and some non-governmental maps. The Board of Geographic Place Names reverted back to the names from Brooks, but did name the Wickersham Wall to honor the judge. Next up was Frederick A. Cook, Dr. Cook. We've covered Cook on a prior episode. We know that he faked the tale of his 1906 climb and was exposed with some climbers going to what he photographed as the peak and found that they were actually far below. Cook did, though. In this first navigation, he circumnavigated the mountain, crossed the Alaska Range on both sides, and set off from and returned to Tyonek. So the first circumnavigation was no small feat. Cook had tried Arctic exploration to the North Pole with Parry in 1891. He then turned to Greenland in 1893-1894, earning accolades from his companions. He was a member of the Belgian Antarctic Exploration with Amundsen. On the 1903 trip to McKinley, he had Robert Dunn, who we talked about here also, a Harvard-educated reporter as his chronicler. A book, The Shameless Diary of an Explorer, tells a tale of a Cook much different than the man described in prior times. Dunn explicitly did not trust Cook, who in the book he only refers to as the leader, never calls him by name. They wasted 9 weeks on the trail and were low on everything and totally unprepared to winter over. They did, however, make it to 11,000 feet on Peters Glacier by the west buttressed route. Here they were buffeted by ferocious winds. They had a terrible time trying to find shelter. This also happened to be Wickersham's highest camp, and Cook's rather depleted party was able to use many of the items cached by Wickersham. While at this camp, they saw a peak which they described and named Mount Hunter in honor of Dunn's aunt. They found their route barricaded by sheer walls and a hanging glacier. And interestingly, the name Mount Hunter on current maps is not the same as the Mount Hunter they named. The current one is a much higher peak, but further south and would not actually have been visible from their camp. Well, they descended through passes, which are still to this day unnamed, to the Chilitna River and on to Susitna Station, which they reached on September 24th. So they've been up in the whole summer when the snow and all the conditions were at their very worst. Now they are back to Susitna Station. In 1906, the south side of the mountain began to be explored for routes to the top. Cook, at this point, still had a positive reputation in spite of Dunn's writing. Cook was honored with memberships in several geographics and alpine societies. He was the president of the Explorers Club. Cook then announced his plans for another attempt on McKinley with a route from the south. He was quite able with his reputation to attract experienced and able men. They ended up with 22 pack horses, a 40-foot, 25-horsepower launch, the Bolshaya. They spent 2 months mapping the upper Yentna, Kahiltna, and Chilitna rivers. They found none of the glaciers offered a route, and they thought only the unexplored northeast slopes may offer something. They returned to Cook Inlet by August 15th. There, some of the party had to depart due to other commitments. Cook could have returned also with a credible amount of mapping and descriptions to show for his efforts. And Belmore Brown then describes what happened in his diary. Basically, he says that when he prepared to depart from Tyonek, Cook gave him a message to telegraph to the Explorers Club. It simply stated, "Am preparing for a last desperate attempt on Mount McKinley." So Cook, at this point, may have had a lot of motivations. He still wanted to go to the North Pole. He had quite a reputation, and he wasn't truly ready to accept defeat at this point. So he then decides that he will go back. Brown continues his diary with an entry regarding several members of the party meeting in Seldovia in September. There, they heard a rumor that Cook and Beryl had attained the summit. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to take a break for some commercials, the weather, and Fox News. So please stay with us at this time. We'll also have some buffer music coming up here in just a few seconds.
Problem Corner is coming up on KFAR 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at KFARradio.com.
New court filings revealing Twitter has been fined for delaying turning over records from former President Trump's account to special counsel Jack Smith.
New York City Mayor Eric Adams is calling on the Biden administration to declare a state of emergency and help his city address a growing surge of migrants.
This will allow federal funds to be allocated quickly to help address the urgent challenges we face.
New York City is set to spend over $5 billion on the crisis this fiscal year. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis suspending State Attorney Monique Worrell, saying she failed to uphold the duties of her office, Worrell calling the move politically motivated.
I did exactly what I said I would do, and that is what you want from an elected official.
Worrell going on to call Governor DeSantis a weak dictator. America is listening to Fox News.
It's time for your Alaska News Minute.
A helicopter that crashed on Alaska's North Slope in July, killing three state scientists and the pilot, stopped sending flight status data to a real-time tracking system as it passed over the southeastern shoreline of an Arctic lake. That is according to a preliminary report on the crash released Tuesday. The Bell 206L-4 helicopter was later found partially submerged and fragmented in the lake, the National Transportation Safety Board report says. The latest data transmissions indicated it was traveling in a northwesterly direction at an altitude of 144 feet above mean sea level with a ground speed of 93 knots. There was no indication in the report of what caused the helicopter to crash into the lake in clear conditions. The cause typically is detailed months later when federal investigators file their final report. The July 20th crash claimed the lives of a pilot and three scientists with Alaska's Department of Natural Resources working in the Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys. The wreckage was recovered from the lake on July 30th and taken by helicopter to Utqiagvik for examination.
Online at KFAR660.com.
Jeans Chrysler Jeep Dodge and Ram Summer of Adventure Giveaway with weekly prizes all summer long and a grand prize giveaway on August 18th. This week's prize list:
a $250 Denali Crow's Nest gift certificate, a $100 Prospector Pizza gift certificate, a $100 49th State Brewing gift certificate.
Enter to win at Jeans, South Cushman at Van Horn Road, the Summer of Adventure Contest.
No purchase necessary to enter to win. See dealership for contest rules.
Jeans, the official dealership of life in Alaska.
Hi, this is Dr. Amy Seiberlich here to tell you about Health Talk. Every Saturday at noon, join Dr. Scott Looper from White Spruce Medical and special guests like me who have our fingers on the pulse of Fairbanks Golden Heart. Learn about a wide range of topics and pick up some beneficial health tips and practical health information pertinent to interior Alaskans. Listen live every Saturday at noon or online anytime at kfarradio.com. Health Talk with Dr. Looper, brought to you by White Spruce Medical. Check us out at whitesprucemedical.com.
If we've learned anything from recent news, it's that unexpected things are happening. Your gut tells you there's something very wrong going on, and all the evidence suggests that there is. Government emails are hacked. There's talk of how to fight World War III, and trade of grains and food are being disrupted. Those in charge say everything's fine, stop noticing, but you know better. It's time to invest in self-reliance and emergency food storage now, more than ever. My Patriot Supply, the nation's largest emergency preparedness company, is the place you can trust. Go to MyPatriotSupply.com and secure their best-selling three-month emergency food kits. Each contains tasty breakfasts, lunch, and dinners, averaging over 2,000 calories per day. Get at least one food kit for each family member. For a limited time, save 25%, plus get free shipping on all their three-month emergency food kits. Go to MyPatriotSupply.com today. It's time to prepare for what's coming. MyPatriotSupply.com.
And now, more Problem Corner on KFAR Radio, 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at KFARradio.com.
Welcome back to KFAR's Problem Corner. We will resume our discussion with myself, Nick Nugent, about the early climbs of Mount McKinley. If you'd like to call in, you can do so by calling 458-TALK or 458-8255. We'll try to get to your call. Well, Cook, we're talking about, who would probably be a subject we could run for three or four programs for all of the controversy that surrounded him, if nothing else, is on his second expedition. Brown is talking about that, and he continues his diary by saying they had heard a rumor that Cook and Beryl had attained the summit. Brown spoke with Beryl alone, and Beryl, the gentleman who had climbed with him, was very elusive regarding the mountain, but he spoke with about other subjects and other lesser peaks. Brown became rather suspicious about this and the rather short amount of time they were away. So Professor Parker, who had been on the first part of the expedition, also agreed that such a climb was impossible under the conditions. Cook finally published in Harper's Monthly magazine in May 1907 with some photos and a map showing the route. It is very notable that no one has ever reached the summit by the route described by Cook. Cook took off for the North Pole, and his critics chose not to attack while he was away. His book, To the Top of the Continent, was published, and one of the photos was used by Brown and Parker to locate the false peak Cook claimed as the summit. During all of this, Cook claimed to have reached the North Pole on April 21st, 1909. Another very long story that could take us an entire program. The story is very convoluted. We'll try to get parts of it in a future broadcast, just because Cook does relate to Alaska. The first crack came when Perry sent his message of his own success. He stated that the native guides noted that Cook had gone no great distance north and was never out of sight of land. If you're very familiar with the polar ice cap, you know that it's a long way from land. After initial rejoicing, Cook's story began to unravel, and it was realized that there was no proof other than Cook's account, and his earlier accounts were under attack. Well, all of these events led the Explorers Club to mount an expedition with the American Geographic Society for the year 1910. Possibly because, or in spite of all this, an expedition was also planned by the Mazamas, a mountain climbing club in Portland, as well as a group from Fairbanks. While these preparations were going on, both Alfred Hughes Brooks and Charles Shelton became convinced by Parker and Brown's arguments and ceased being Cook's supporters. Well, because of Alaska's small population, a person's circle of acquaintance could spread far. Hudson Stuck corresponded with Brooks, Harry Karstens with Charles Sheldon. Because of this, news traveled back to Fairbanks rapidly, and a group began to make plans for their own attempt. This was based on general indignation toward Cook and outside parties in general, and the general feeling that Fairbanks residents could just do the job well and honestly. The expedition was led by Tom Lloyd, included Pete Anderson, Billy Taylor, Charlie McGonigal. Last-minute additions were C.E. Davidson, who became the Surveyor General of Alaska, and two of his friends, W. Lloyd and a Mr. Horn. They left Fairbanks on December 22, 1909, per the Fairbanks Daily Times. They were using dog teams, horses, and a mule. The party was well-planned and pretty well-financed. There was a story of a $5,000 bet, which was reported in the New York Sun, which was based on the ability to reach the summit by July 4, 1910. One thing that was unknown to both Brooks in 1902 and Cook in 1903 was that the Muldrow Glacier gave access to a large basin from which either peak could be accessed. They also knew routes to the Muldrow from their time in the Kantishna. The Muldrow then had been proven in 1906 when Charles Shelton traveled far enough up the glacier to put the routes in their proper context. Lloyd's party then established a winter camp at Cache Creek. They made the first camp on the mountain on February 27th. They descended to hunt caribou for the group, and at this juncture an unfortunate event occurred when Lloyd started a fist fight with Davidson. The cause of the fight is unknown, but it led to the departure of Davidson and his two friends. This was a fatal blow because at this time they now did not have either a surveyor or a photographer turning the effort in to a recreational event. And a photographer under the conditions on the mountains at this time, that was a very, very technical job. It's not like pulling up your phone and snapping off a few selfies. There was a lot of work to preparing plates, keeping them safe, and developing them. Well, nothing then was heard of this expedition until Lloyd, on April 11th, reappeared in Fairbanks alone. He stated all four had reached both peaks, the South Peak on April 3rd at 3:25 p.m. Again, the press ran with the story. It was picked up by New York papers, and on the 14th, President Harding sent a congratulatory telegram. The New York Times disputed the ascent as soon as April 16th. Sheldon gave a negative view regarding the event and cautioned a wait until the rest of the party returned from the Kantishna. Well, now, Lloyd called for a second climb by the party in Kantishna. This was reported on the 9th of June, 1910, as having success on May 17th. Photos were published by the New York Times magazine on June 5th and the London Times on June 6th. These pretty much had to have been from the first climb, as there would not have been enough time to forward the photos. Eventually, this attempt was thought to be false also. The controversy surrounding Cook certainly did not in any way help Lloyd. Well, Parker and Brown departed for Alaska in early May 1910. They were determined to find the peak Cook claimed as the summit. They had copies of the route map Cook produced, as well as uncropped photos. One of the things Cook had done with his photos was crop them so other peaks in the area could not be seen. So Beryl was not brought along, as he'd become a little bit too controversial a figure to be on the expedition. Beryl, in fact, later stated he and Cook likely had not been above 5,000 feet. Well, this party then included expert surveyors and photographers. At Susitna Station, they encountered the party dispatched by the Mazama Mountaineering Club of Oregon. Mazama's party consisted of four members, and their leader was C.E. Rusk. Rusk was a Cook supporter. Both, you kind of wonder how they got along, but apparently it was a cordial relationship. Both parties traveled up the Susitna to the Chulitna, finally to the Tokositna, to the terminus of Ruth Glacier, named for Cook's daughter. If we look at all the travel today, it's kind of interesting when you go during climbing season down to Talkeetna and watch K2 Aviation hauling, making dozens of trips per day, hauling climbers up. The amount of time that some of these parties spent arriving at the base of the mountain from Cook Inlet, usually the village of Tyonek, was often much greater than the length of time that modern parties take to make the entire climb. They did, though, do a lot of good exploration. A lot of the exploration up the valleys, different things they did, were quite valuable to other geographers and other scientists. So, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to take another commercial break at this time. We'll be back shortly.
More Problem Corner is coming up on KFAR 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at kfarradio.com.
Interior Community Health Center provides quality primary care that is truly accessible to all. Eligible families with or without insurance can access our wide range of medical services by taking advantage of our sliding fee discount. Our comprehensive approach to wellness and state-of-the-art facility has earned us the Health Resources and Services Administration's Quality Awards. Learn more at interiorcommunityhealth.org or make an appointment. Call 907-455-4567. That's 907-455-4567.
Nowadays, nothing is more important than saving money. And the best way to do that is with the radio station's 50-50 Friday offer. Every week, a different special from a different local business, offering gift certificates at half price. All from your favorite restaurants, shops, and events. So what's this week's 50-50 Friday offer?
This week is Friar Tuck's Hoagie House off Miramar Avenue. Awesome food and spirits, tons of big TVs with sports in every corner. Plus amazing food like the Po' Boy Roll, Tuck's Roll, Southwest Roll, and don't forget those incredible Hoodoo Cheese Fries. Everything on the menu can be made keto style as well. And don't miss half price happy hour on all the fabulous appetizers. And this week, you'll get two $25 gift certificates for half price. Friar Tuck's Hoagie House up Miramar, next to Verizon. Friar Tuck's, come for the food, stay for 50-50 Friday. Only at Friar Tuck's Hoagie House.
Just log on to this station's website and click on that red 50-50 tag in the upper right-hand corner. Have your credit card ready and get ready to save big. 50-50 Friday, every Friday at 9 a.m. from the radio station.
Spend your Saturdays with KFAR Radio for local programs, starting with Alaska Realty Today from Next Home Arctic Sun Realty at 11 a.m. The Buzz at 11:30. Brought to you by the Tanana Herb Company. Followed by Health Talk with Dr. Scott Looper from White Spruce Medical at noon. And then it's the Compos Outdoor Show at 12:30. Fairbanks Foodies at 1 p.m. And Explore Fairbanks at 1:30. All 3 hours of local shows can be found on the KFAR website in the archives section. Weekends just got local with KFAR Radio.
Weather brought to you by GCR. Find Bridgestone and Cooper tires for every car, truck, motor, home, and SUV you drive. Everything you tow. GCR Tires and Service. The Tire Guys. Taming the Alaskan Road. Van Horn at Cushman.
KFAR. Weather.
Scattered thunderstorms likely today. Otherwise cloudy. High temperatures reach up to 69. Southerly winds around 5 miles per hour. Scattered thunderstorms again tonight. Lows dip down to about 57. Overcast skies. Scattered thunderstorms likely tomorrow. High temperatures reach up to 73. Cloudy skies expected. And that's your weather on KFAR 660 AM and 97.5 FM. I'm meteorologist Paul Trombley.
And now, more Problem Corner on KFAR Radio, 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at KFARradio.com.
Welcome back to KFAR's Problem Corner. We're going to resume our discussion with myself, Nick Nugent, about the early climbs on Mount McKinley. If you'd like to call in, you can do so by calling 458-TALK or 458-8255. We will try to get to your call. Well, the Mazama party was already up on the mountain and had been through the area that Belmore Brown's group was, Parker and Brown, were now coming to. They actually went to an area about 20 air miles southeast of the true summit. On June 16th, they were fairly sure they spotted the peak that Cook had photographed. Weather slowed them down, but on the 22nd, they found enough evidence that they moved to the point and they confirmed that peak, which was not the summit, and they were able to follow Cook's map and obtain actual photos of the summit for comparison. So the Mazama party had believed Cook, of course, and after weeks of struggle up the Great Glacier, they came to a point about 10 miles southeast of the summit, where it became very, very obvious that Cook's map went from reasonable accuracy to complete fantasy. At this point, the Ruth Glacier makes a sharp turn and flows in from the west. Cook's map depicted it as turning to the east and northeast. With dwindling supplies, they quit the mountain on July 15th. They left a supply of alcohol for their stoves and marked it for the other party. On their return, Rusk published the volume of data collected, which concluded Cook could not have done what he claimed. Later, Friend wrote of Cook's earlier accomplishments and kudos. He concluded that Cook had so wanted the North Pole attempt that his judgment was clouded, and he thought that any failure on Mount McKinley might stop that effort. Well, now we go on to 1912. The Fairbanks Daily Times decided to send their own team, in part, to make up for the embarrassment of having written favorably about the whole Cook affair. On February 6, 1912, the Fairbanks papers carried the announcement of a party led by Ralph Cairns, who was an editor of the Fairbanks Daily Times. Also along was Martin Nash, who had packed over Chilkoot Pass, and a Fairbanks man, George S. Lewis. Not a one of these men had even the slightest experience with climbing. Their whole experience with mountains was probably looking to the south and going, boy, those are nice mountains. Well, Jack Phillips joined them at Chena, and he was in charge of 23 dogs pulling four sleds each with 500 pounds of supplies each. In February then, an article appeared, and it stated the climbers were safe at McKinley's base. Phillips had returned with the story and brought the extra dogs back. Then on April 12, 1912, a headline, "Unable to scale heights, climbing party returns." They were able to get up to about 10,000 feet again at or near Gunsight Pass on what's now the Pioneer Ridge. They saw the Muldrow Glacier below, and Cairns reckoned that they could have made the glacier in a month. So their supplies were too low. They had been lashed by terrific storms while climbing and nearly suffered loss of life. So this ended the eighth attempt. It was again Professor Parker and Belmore Brown's turn. Their plan was to approach in winter from the south across to the north side and attempt the climb from the Muldrow. From conversations with Karstens, Lloyd, and Sheldon, they were convinced that this was the best and true path. They arrived in Seward the 1st of February and found the town in an uproar at the amount of gold which had been shipped from the Iditarod mines. They reached the head of the Chilitna on March 20th and were camped in timber on the McKinley River on April 17th, 1912. While hunting caribou and sheep, they came upon some of Cairns' recently used cabins and found multiple copies of the Fairbanks Daily Times speculating on how successful Brown and Parker would be. They reached Midway on the Muldrow by way of McGonigal Pass. Their diaries call it Glacier Pass. They spotted the key access to the high basin above. The men went back to base camp to leave the dogs and stayed at the lower elevations for several weeks. In early June, they set out for the summit. Possibly that delay caused them some problems because the weather in early June is not as good as the weather in May would have been. Well, they made a number of higher camps, and on June 8th, they noticed a booming, which they thought came from the glacier moving around, but on their return found it, in fact, was from an eruption of Mount Katmai about 400 miles distant. After making a number of higher and higher camps and caches, they camped in the valley between the peaks on June 27th. The climb upward was very slow. They were hardly making 400 feet an hour. At around 18,500 feet, they topped a big ridge. They went upward to somewhere between 19 and 20,000 feet when a storm hit. The storm and blizzard drove them all the way back to 18,000 feet. They were also hampered by the thin air and just slogging along. They again started upward, the altimeter registering 20,000 feet. So they were within 300, if the altimeter was correct, they were within 300 feet. There was no shelter here. They were again beaten back by the wind, and they retreated to their 16,000-foot camp. A new problem arose when all of them began to become ill from the pemmican in their supplies, and they ran out of other food. After 2 days' recovery, they tried again. They reached 19,300 when another huge storm struck from the south, and they again retreated. Their dietary problems caused them to be too weakened to try again, and they retreated down the mountain, reaching Snowline 2 days later. While resting at Cache Creek on July 6th, an earthquake took place. While they looked up, the entire face of Mount Brooks avalanched, and snow and winds reached them 10 miles away. They were unable to make, or they were able then to make the Kantishna mines, and from there, home. They found lack of evidence of the Lloyd party, which caused the Lloyd effort to be dismissed as a hoax, about as bad as that of Cook. Within a year, though, this conclusion was completely reversed. Alaskans made the first successful ascent of the summit in 1913. Cook was still claiming the first ascent and wrote extensive articles in 1910 and later. In 1913, he wrote an introduction to Cairns' climb, which he mostly used to defend his own claims. He also lists a climb in 1911, for which there is no record anywhere, and it is likely just another myth of the mountain. He did list a claim that well-known engineer R.C. Bates had confirmed his route of 1906 to the 11,000-foot mark. Well, against all of this, Archdeacon Hudson Stuck and Harry Karsten set off for the Kantishna. They had the eventual destination, the summit of Mount McKinley. Both were extremely experienced Alaska hands. Karsten's had been famous for running mail routes. Stuck traveled hundreds of miles by dog sled. Karsten's had worked for Charles Sheldon in 1906 and 8. Karsten's had actually for years tried to interest Sheldon in a McKinley summit attempt. Sheldon, having no mountaineering experience, always declined. Stuck was 50 years old at this time. Stuck had climbed in Colorado, the Canadian Rockies, and Mount Rainier. His longing to climb Mount McKinley was first sparked when, on one of his journeys, he saw the mountain from the top of Pedro Dome and was struck with its size and majesty. So they had a volunteer group, which each man donated their own time. The effort was financed for just under $1,000, a fraction of the costs of many of the others, which had went up to 20 and more thousand. The party consisted of men with connections to Stuck and included Walter Harper, son of Arthur Harper, Robert G. Tatum. Tatum had made many winter trips in support of the missionaries. And finally, two teenage boys, Johnny and Esaias, who tended the dogs in camp and brought the extra dogs back. Starting in mid-May, they found the Muldrow Glacier by following the route of the 1910 expedition. They had expected an easy passage based on Belmore Brown's accounts, but found a mass of strewn ice blocks and boulders from the 1912 earthquake. They ended up cutting a 3-mile staircase over the course of 3 weeks. Karsten's and Harper were the trailblazers, and Tatum and Stuck relayed supplies. On May 27th, they got past the avalanche rubble. A few days later, while resting, Harper saw the flagpole set on the North Peak by the sourdough climbers, Lloyd's party. Thus, they proved the claims of that climbing party. They made camps at 15,000, 16,000, 16,500, 17,000, and finally 18,000 feet. The reason I list all those is it shows what a slow route they had to the top. And at that altitude, how long it took. Most of these men weren't really aware of the problem of working at extreme altitude. Well, they carried 2 full weeks of food and fuel. Stuck noted they had been above snow line for 48 days. They were a determined and well-prepared group. They noted that they slept warm. They had sheep and caribou hides below them, wool blankets and wolf robes on top, and they used a small Primus stove, which ran on kerosene. You can actually see that stove at the University of Alaska Museum. Well, they set out then for the summit, which was an arduous task due to weather and altitude. Harper went first. He was the first to set foot on the peak. The great mountain had been summited June 7th, 1913. That's our program for today. I've been very happy to be here. And now we're off for Fox News.
A new court filing reveals Special Counsel Jack Smith's team obtained a search warrant for records related to former President Trump's Twitter account.
A federal appeals court has rejected Twitter's request to toss a $350,000 fine levied by a lower court judge for its delay in compliance.